Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for July 11, 2002. We've got three guests scheduled for tonight. First, we'll speak with Charles Komenoff, enemy of the car, economist, transportation consultant, about his campaign to put tolls in the East River bridges. Then we'll talk to Steffi Woolhandler about an article she co-wrote on some surprising facts about healthcare finance in the U.S. How it turns out that our government spends more per person on healthcare than almost every other country in the world, including just about all of those with universal publicly funded health insurance systems. And then finally, we'll speak with Michael Perlman, economist and author of the book Steal This Idea, Intellectual Property Rights and the Corporate Confiscation of Creativity, just published by Palgrave. And before we get to Charlie Komenoff, which we'll call him in just a couple minutes, but I wanted to say a couple of words about the array of scandals we've got going on in the business world. It's quite an array, isn't it? I can't decide whether I'm more outraged or delighted. After a decade of complacency and braggadocio, not that either was ever in short supply here, but it was an extreme even by our own standards, the U.S. economic model is looking more and more like a conjuring trick than the envy of the world. Every day, it seems, brings another revelation of cooked books and well-timed stock sales. Most deliciously, it extends to the top two elected officials in the country, President W., who sold his stock in a company that was about to crash before everyone else learned about it, and then forgot to file the proper forms of the SEC, and also Vice President Cheney, who ran the oil services company Halliburton from 1995 to 2000, while it was performing some interesting experiments in accounting. Cheney, who a few months ago was allegedly hiding from terrorists, is now hiding from reporters. Of course, these are no mere accidents. These two guys emerged from the very corporate culture that's now wallowing in disgrace. And the stock market, how about that stock market? It stabilized a bit today, but the decline over the last week has been stunning. It's been amazing to watch all the illusions that that institution fostered during the 1990s evaporating as well. But here's where it gets serious. The fall in the stock market is almost certainly dragging down the real economy and preventing any kind of vigorous recovery. More people are telling pollsters that they're postponing big purchases and are worrying about their financial situation now and in their eventual retirement, assuming that after all this is over, they can afford to retire. For a decade, people were conned into believing that the market would save for them. That's what the public social public social security system couldn't provide, the stock market would. As I've argued here many times, there's no problem with the social security system, but clearly there is a real problem with the stock market. After a bubble like the 1990s, it's very unlikely that the market will show any vigor for many, many years to come. And the weak stock market is also holding down business investment, which is the key to longer-term recovery and growth. Yes, I know there are severe ecological constraints on growth, but under our present political and economic arrangements, weak or no growth means unemployment, poverty, insecurity, and austerity. So my pleasure in the humiliation of the powerful is considerably compromised by thinking of all the collateral damage it's doing to ordinary people, those of us who just got a few crumbs from the late boom. And my pleasure in scandal is restrained by the knowledge that just focusing on some bad apples diverts our attention from the rest of the barrel, that is, the structural problems of American capitalism, a system that creates poverty and toxic waste, along with all the wealth it does create. I'm hoping that the disgrace of the NASDAQ and George W. might make people think about these larger issues, but I'm not optimistic. There was a great revival of radical politics during the late 1990s, the so-called anti-globalization movement, for example. But that may well have been a byproduct of the boom. The last time the economy sank into long-term stagnation, in the 1970s, we saw a period of right-wing ascendancy. I hope that's not what happens this time around. And speaking of that growth of the anti-globalization movement, there's a film about the Harvard students' living wage sit-in, which was covered on this show while it was happening. A movie is called Occupation, and it's playing tonight through Sunday night at 6:40 p.m. at the Pioneer Theater, 155 East 3rd Street in Manhattan. The directors will be on hand to talk about the Harvard Living Wage campaign and their movie. And they will be joined by Liza Featherstone, who is the author of the book Students Against Sweatshops. And since Liza is the love of my life, it would be very unethical for me to
tell you what a wonderful book it is and how you should all go to the Pioneer Theater tonight and listen to her at 155 East 3rd Street at 640. And would it also be unethical of me to tell you to visit studentsagainstsweatshops.com for information about the book. So I won't do any of those things. But anyway, again, that movie Occupation, a film about the Harvard Living Wage sit-in tonight and narrated by Ben Affleck, for those of you who are moved by star power. That's, again, 6:40 p.m. tonight, the Pioneer Theater, 155 East 3rd Street in Manhattan, tonight through Sunday night at 6:40 every night. And we'll be back in a moment to talk to Charlie Kominoff. We're back with, after that little interlude disaster from the arty band Fisher Spooner, and that seemed appropriate to the themes of the evening. And we now are joined by Charles Kominoff, who is an economist and transportation consultant and an enemy of the automobile, like me, so I like to have Charlie on every now and then to bash cars. Welcome to WBAR, Charles.
Hey, Doug, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, great summary.
I wanted to talk about a couple of things. First of all, people are celebrating some legislation in California as a great environmental advance. Could you describe, first of all, what happened and why you're a bit more skeptical than some people?
Well, the California legislature just passed a bill that is awaiting Governor Gray Davis' signature that is being hailed by all the good and righteous foes of global warming, which, of course, includes you and me and our listeners, as the first step in rolling back ever-cascading emissions of carbon dioxide and leading to a stable and healthful climate for the planet. Would that it were so. And what the bill does is basically order the state Air Resources Board to set higher mileage standards, MPG regulations for cars sold in California. And while there's nothing wrong with that, in fact, that's exactly what the U.S. Congress failed to do earlier this year, kind of an absurd head-in-the-sand attitude. But in order to pass the legislation, the legislature has forsworn any other step to reduce emissions of carbon dioxide from California cars and trucks, including a whole panoply of measures that arguably would be not only more effective in reducing the amount of gasoline consumed in California, but would also improve transportation. And when you consider that the legislation is likely, if it's passed by the governor, to end up in court on the grounds that it preempts federal standards, this might go down not even as a Pyrrhic victory, but as a Pyrrhic defeat, where California, instead of leading the country to reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases, may end up furthering the retreat that is was evident in Washington during the Clinton years and has now been accelerating during the Bush-Cheney years.
Well, there are people also who talk over the longer term about hybrid vehicles and getting emissions down that way. Even if we could get emissions down to zero, which may not be practically possible, you would also still have some reservations about a car-centered transportation system.
Well, sure. I mean, look, let's at least agree, though, that it would be wonderful and important to reduce the amount of gasoline, that cars consume for a whole bunch of reasons.
Absolutely agreed. Yeah,
that's oil,
uncontroversial in this room here.
Yeah. The problem with the California legislation is that there are so many more effective ways to reduce not just gasoline, but the amount of vehicular travel. For example, weight distance fees that would be levied on all the cars and trucks in California that would be proportional to the amount of miles driven in a year, and would also be proportional to the weight of the vehicle, so that an SUV would pay twice as much per mile as a subcompact car, and an 18-wheeler would pay 10 or 20 times as much as either. But more importantly, any car that's driven, say, 500 miles a week, you know, it's a lot, would pay 10 times as much as a car that's only driven, say, 50 miles a week because its owner is carpooling or using a bike or taking the bus or is going to a closer destination. So basically, the MPG method of controlling carbon dioxide, it's a pretty small bullet, and it only goes to one of the problems of the cars, namely the oil consumption and everything related to it, and does nothing about the sprawl, about the mass killing and maiming of people in cars and trucks, about the fact that it's increasingly difficult for anybody, especially kids, to bike and walk anywhere in the United States because of the overuse of cars, as well as the rampant traffic congestion, which is destroying crimping millions of lives in the United States. So it's just another instance, this California legislation, which was celebrated in a New York Times editorial on Monday, California leads the way, of the environmental movement, I think, just literally not knowing what is going on and focusing on a tiny part of the problem that maybe they can get their arms around, and ignoring all the things that they're unable to solve because they haven't been able to build a powerful grassroots movement in this country.
Yeah, I only drive several times a year, but every time I do, I'm just amazed at the traffic involved. I don't know how people put up with it. Just hours on end of bumper-to-bumper creeping, and this is supposed to be efficient. I don't quite understand that. But how would you implement this distance and weight pricing system?
Well, it's actually, there were, sorry if I'm not more up on this, a handful of states that had weight distance taxes on heavy trucks. And it was a way of generating revenue, and that would offset the damage that trucks do to roadways, let alone what they do to the environment and the communities that they rumble through. And this would have to be extended, or ideally should be extended, to every motor vehicle that's registered in California and in all the other 49 states. And clearly, we are at a point with electronics where it shouldn't be too difficult to record in some accurate, non-tamperable way the amount of miles driven by a vehicle, and clearly the weight of the vehicle is known, or at least the weight of the vehicle when it's sold. And then the charges would be billed to each driver and would be paid, who knows, four times a year to the relevant government agency. And so much revenue could be generated this way that you could begin to reduce and, depending on the levels, even eliminate sales taxes, which are, of course, the most regressive tax going in the country. So when people complain that taxes on gasoline or taxes on miles driven or weight distance fees like this might be regressive because, poor people who drive long distances and who have heavy cars would be hit hard, they're ignoring the fact that the taxes that could be offset and eliminated as a result of these weight distance fees are far more regressive.
People, of course, would have, if you're talking about electronic sensors that could track how much you drive, people would have severe privacy concerns about this. The government would know what we're doing and where we're going, wouldn't it?
Well, I guess the government would know how many miles we drive. Is that such a terrible thing? They wouldn't have to know where people go. It wouldn't be the kind of chip with a global positioning system unless you wanted it. I don't see where privacy is an issue. Unfortunately, some among the left raise privacy as a reason to not put tolls on the East River bridges.
I want to get to that in a second, but I want to finish this topic. Then we get to that. When you start talking about raising the cost of driving, which is what you're talking about, people will say that's not fair. We already pay a lot of money for a car. You pay a lot of money for gas, and it's just burdensome to raise the cost of transportation.
Yeah, the beleaguered motorist.
Yeah. So, give us some idea of what share of the actual costs of the automobile are incurred by or paid for by drivers.
Well, half a dozen years ago, we did a study for the Tri-State Transportation Campaign here in New York, where we totaled up all the revenue or all the taxes and fees that drivers pay in the state of New York, you know, not just the obvious things like gasoline taxes or tolls or tickets, but hidden taxes like the wholesale petroleum business tax, which in fact is passed along in the cost of gasoline. But then we compared that to the services that state and federal and local governments provide to drivers in New York State in terms of building and maintaining roads and adjudicating tickets, policing the roads, taking, you know, removing traffic accidents, etc. And basically, we found that in New York State, drivers are paying 65 cents on the dollar of the cost that they are incurring. So they're getting a subsidy of 35 cents from government, from everybody else's taxes, for the driving that they do. And in New Jersey, where we did the same study a year later, the drivers were paying about 70 cents, so the subsidy was a fraction less. It was 30 cents.
And does this include, like, health effects of pollution?
No health effects. For example, the accident costs are simply what it costs emergency medical technicians and police to clean up after accidents, as well as the police to prevent accidents, you know, if you believe, in fact, that police are actually out there preventing accidents when it appears what they're doing is simply speeding traffic flow. So none of the so-called externality costs were included in this analysis. If you
nothing did, like lost wages or pain and suffering or anything like that?
No, you know, or the taxes that go to pay and maintain American military power and project it across the globe so that U.S. motorists can continue getting all the gasoline they think they need. None of that was included in that analysis. So the notion of the beleaguered motorist who's paying huge amounts of money, you know, it's true that the tolls on the MTA crossings, like, say, the Triborough Bridge or the Midtown Tunnel, that a lot of that, happily, does go to support mass transit. But when you add up all the costs, the drivers in the New York area are getting quite a free ride.
All right, which brings us to the final point. You are campaigning now to put tolls on the East River bridges, both as for the reasons we've been talking about, but also because the city's in dire budgetary straits. Could you talk about that?
Yes, we've got a new website. It's been put together by a colleague of mine with Right of Way, that being, of course, the pedestrian rights group that I work with these days. Steve O'Neill and I have created a website. We launched it a month or 2 months ago called bridgetolls.org. And it's basically a sort of electronic town meeting to marshal support for instituting tolls on the East River bridges, not in some far-off future, but as soon as possible. And what we're trying to convey is a sense of urgency that every day that the city doesn't toll the Queensboro, Brooklyn, Williamsburg, and Manhattan bridges, the four free bridges across the East River, the city is losing around $2 million in revenue that is desperately needed to maintain vital services of schools, libraries, parks, health services, et cetera, which is not to say that East River bridge tolls by themselves are going to close the entire NYC budget gap, but they could have a significant impact, as well as improving traffic flow so that truckers and essential goods could flow more freely, and even diehard motorists are going to benefit because removing a small amount of cars from the congested traffic flow on the bridges and on the approaches and exits will have a disproportionately big effect in reducing traffic congestion. So we see bridge tolls as a win-win solution, and actually this new website, bridgetolls.org, is surprisingly for me free of the anti-car rhetoric that I think is so right on, because what we're trying to do in this instance is bring together all New Yorkers, whether they own cars or drive them or not, into a critical mass that will push bridge tolls over the political top ASAP.
All right. Well, thank you, Charles Komenoff. Charles Komenoff is an economist and a transportation consultant. And that website, again, bridgetolls, all one word, .org. And remember, many of us in New York City don't drive cars, so this is an unusual jurisdiction in that regard. So it's not the losing battle that might be somewhere else. And speaking of cars and sprawl in suburbs, let's hear this little musical interlude before we bring on Steffi Woolhandler.
Suburbia. I
Jews.
And so was I. She was a Jewish girl. I fell in love with her. She wrote a number on the back of my hand. I called her up. I was all out of breath. I said, come hear me play in a rock and roll band.
And that was a little bit from Dean Friedman's 1977 hit, Ariel, which, if you didn't hear it, she was collecting quarters for the Friends of BAI. I think that one of the most prominent mentions of WBAI in the popular culture, and also full of New Jersey local color, my home stomping grounds. We're now joined by Steffi Woolhandler, who is a physician, as well as the co-author of many, many studies of healthcare finance in the United States, with David Himmelstein, her frequent collaborator, and they have put together a piece in the current issue of Health Affairs, a journal of, as it says, policy of about health issues. Paying for national health insurance and not getting it. And the final line of the piece is really, I think, a good way to start, which is, our healthcare financing system is usually portrayed as largely private. Public money, private control is a more apt description. Welcome to WBAI, Steffi Woolhandler.
Well, thanks, Doug.
So could you flesh that out a bit? Public money, private control, what do you mean?
Well, Americans are now paying the highest healthcare-related taxes of any people in the world. This year, the average American will pay $3,200 in taxes that go to healthcare, in addition to what other taxes they're paying. That's a higher figure than people have probably heard before if they're following this, because in that figure we've included not just direct tax-funded health care like Medicare and Medicaid, but we've also included the taxes that people pay to support, for instance, the health benefits of public workers like teachers and firemen. We've also included this huge tax subsidy for purchasing private insurance that goes primarily to wealthy taxpayers. So when you add all those things up, it turns out that about 60% of all health spending in the United States is paid for by taxpayers. And because we're paying so much in health care, turns out just that tax-funded portion is more than the total cost of health care in any other country on Earth. A little bit of a complicated...
You're speaking in relative terms, not, you know, because the United States is very much larger than most other economies.
Oh, I'm talking in
about
per capita terms.
Yeah.
In per capita basis, the taxes that the average taxpayer is paying, the $3,200 in taxes that the average taxpayer will be paying to support health care in this country, is more than the total cost of health care on a per capita basis in any country in Europe, anywhere in North America, Australia, with one exception, and Switzerland actually has slightly more in total health spending than we have in tax-funded health spending per capita.
And, of course, these are countries that have universal or near-universal coverage. They're not with 20% of the population not covered.
All other developed nations do have universal coverage and all have used some sort of national health insurance mechanism to make it happen, and yet they're ending up on a per capita basis paying less in taxes to support health care than taxpayers in the United States.
Now, let's step back a bit. I mean, we know that, and I think a lot of people know already, that Medicare and Medicaid pay a very large percentage of the health care bill in the U.S., and that's direct government spending. And that accounts for, what, about 45% of the total spending?
Right. Medicare, Medicaid, and military spending, like the VA or for the active duty military, is about 45%. And then there's another 15% that's made up by spending for the health benefits of public employees.
And that's what earlier studies haven't really looked at, and that's what you're doing here, right?
Right. And there's, if you think of it, the health benefits of an FBI agent are paid by taxes in the same way that the health benefits of an active duty military person are paid by taxes. And it's just a quirk in the accounting system that those have been kept separate in previous reports of tax-funded spending. And all we've done is just added those things together. Anything that taxpayers pay for that goes to health care, we've considered tax finance spending. And that's how you end up with the estimate of 60% of total health spending being tax financed, translating into $3,200 in tax financed health spending per capita in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, government employment is a very large, I mean, I think it's about, if I'm remembering right, it's about 15% of total employment in the U.S., so almost all those people have health benefits, and those are paid for by public funds, and that's
right.
Sort of gets lost in the accounting.
Right. Well, the government government employees are more likely to get health insurance through their jobs than private sector employees. I mean, we think that's a good thing about government employment. Obviously, everybody ought to get health insurance. But for that reason, the government is paying a fairly large share of the what's been called private insurance market. So when people think of private health insurance, they don't remember that, in fact, government employees make up a big portion of that market. About 22% of all private health insurance in the United States is for government employees.
And then what a lot of people don't look at all is the tax subsidies that you're rather – well, hidden in some sense, but there is a publicly available accounting for all these. So give us the rundown of how the tax code subsidizes.
Okay. Well, the tax subsidies are amount to $120 billion a year, and those subsidies are primarily for the purchase of private health insurance. And the way the subsidy works is when your employer purchases health insurance on your behalf, that money is not counted as income. Even though it's part of your compensation package, you don't pay income tax or Social Security taxes on that. The amount of money that's lost to the Treasury and has to be made up from other taxpayers is actually huge. The total amount of the tax subsidy to private health insurance is at least $120 billion a year. And the problem with it is that it's highly regressive. That means that the tax subsidies go primarily to wealthy people. And, for instance, if you take a family with income above $100,000 a year, the value of this tax subsidy is more than $2,300. If you take a family with less than $15,000 a year, the value of the value of the subsidy is only $71. So this huge $120 billion tax break goes primarily to very wealthy Americans. And the size of the tax break is similar to the size of, for instance, the federal contribution to the Medicaid program for care of the poor. So we're talking real money here. And again, the tax subsidy, it seems sort of nebulous if you're not familiar with the field, but it's actually very well recognized in health policy circles. In fact, a figure for the tax subsidy, what the budget office calls a tax expenditure, the figure actually appears in the federal budget every year. So it's a well understood subsidy within the healthcare finance community. It's well accepted in the medical literature, and it means that taxpayers have to make up through other taxes what has been given as a tax break to primarily wealthy people.
And, of course, since a lot of state tax systems piggyback on the federal structure, a lot of state systems also repeat that subsidy, which goes to people who have are more likely to have health insurance or likely to, than poorer people and have better health insurance than poorer
right.
people.
Right, and also the higher incomes of wealthy people mean the value of a tax break is going to be much bigger for them. So it is really highly regressive, and that's the problem with using tax subsidies. In general, they're very regressive. Tax subsidies usually are worth a lot more to rich people than to poor people, and they tend to be hidden. People don't debate the tax subsidy. You know, state legislators spend all the time debating Medicaid and cutting back things to poor people. And meanwhile, they ignore a huge tax break to wealthy people that's costing taxpayers just as much. But no one's going to talk about it because it's hidden. It's implicit.
I'm speaking with Steffi Woolhandler, who is a physician and a prominent member of Physicians for a National Health Program and co-author of a piece in the current issue of Health Affairs, a journal of health policy called Paying for National Health Insurance and Not Getting It. And this is WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, and my name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. And you also do some inspection of a historical record here. What's happened to public and private health spending in the U.S. and other countries over the last 20, 30 years?
Well, in the late 1960s, tax-financed health spending in the United States was relatively small. But by 1999, which was the year that we looked at in detail, that government spending had grown tremendously to where 60% of all health expenditures was tax-financed, and the amount that taxpayers were putting in to support health care in 1999 was more than enough to fully fund national health insurance for all Americans. So we were, in effect, by 1999, already as taxpayers paying the full cost of universal health care, but we just weren't getting it. And, you know, the irony of this is that uninsured families are paying thousands of dollars in taxes for the health care of other people. And, you know, that's got to be profoundly ironic.
Now, you and David have Himmelstein have done a lot of work on the costs of our private insurance system. The standard line, familiar to anyone who can turn on a talk radio in the United States, is that public sector, inefficient. Private sector, efficient. In this particular area, that's a very, very wrong statement. Could you remind us just how inefficient private health insurance is?
Okay. Well, there's only two choices about who's going to run health insurance. It's either going to be the government or it's going to be the private insurance industry. And if you look at the numbers, government is much more efficient at running insurance. You could just look at our Social Security system that runs at a much lower overhead than private pension funds. But within health care, our Medicare program runs at an overhead of around 3%, whereas private health insurance has an average overhead of about 13%, with some of the HMOs, like Cigna in one recent year, having overhead that ran as high as 33% of total premiums. I mean, that means you pay a dollar in premiums, you only get 67 cents back in hospital care, doctor care, nursing care. 33 cents on the dollar was staying with Cigna for their overhead and profits. So there's a huge inefficiency in having a private insurance industry run your health care system. We've estimated, and it's been confirmed by the U.S. General Accounting Office, that about $150 billion every year could be saved in administrative simplification if you had a health insurance system modeled after Social Security, where everyone was automatically eligible, everyone automatically covered.
Sorry, we lost about 10 seconds of material there while the tape was being flipped. Now, back to the program.
It's fragmented. So in any given region, there may be dozens or even hundreds of different insurance plans, each of which has to have their own claims processing apparatus. They've got their own rules, their own eligibility, their own enrollment. So there's a lot of duplication when you have a fragmented system. The other thing is, in a private insurance system, you have a lot of administrative work that you don't have to do in a public program. So the private insurance companies have to market the insurance. They have to do something called underwriting, where they figure out who they're going to make a profit off of and who they aren't, and how much to charge for the premiums in order to make those profits. Those kinds of administrative functions are not present in a public system. In a public system, everyone's automatically enrolled, and you don't have to sit around and figure out what to set the premiums for on any given individual, because everybody's going to be in there and it's going to be tax supported. So it's both a question of fragmentation, having hundreds of different insurance plans in an area, and the idea that a private insurance company has to do a lot more administrative work related to figuring out whether they're going to make a profit or not.
Well, now let's talk about the politics for a second. It seemed that after the failure of the Clinton health plan in, what was it, 94, that this whole issue kind of fell off fell out of political discourse. Is it dead? Is it bubbling under the surface? What are the politics of some kind of more sensible approach to healthcare finance?
Well, healthcare becomes an issue whenever healthcare costs go up. And it was an issue in the late 80s and early 90s because healthcare costs were rising at double-digit rates. Healthcare costs were flat in the mid to late 90s, and we weren't hearing a lot about healthcare reform. But now we do hear that healthcare costs are again really skyrocketing. Major purchasers of private insurance are reporting double-digit increases in their premiums. And what happens when healthcare costs go up, particularly in a cooling economy, is a lot of people start to lose their health insurance because their employer tries to raise the rates or stop offering insurance. State state budgets no longer have surpluses to let them expand Medicaid. So in that circumstance, you see the number of uninsured people going up, and you even see many people in the corporate world, the employer community, starting to demand that something be done. Now, the employer community may have very different ideas from us about what should be done. Nonetheless, they do open up a discussion about health care reform when they see their costs going through the roof. And that's the kind of situation we're in 2002. We think there'll be a major reopening of the reform debate over the next 6 to 12 months. I'm not the only person who says that. That's really pretty much agreed upon within the health policy community that the debate will reopen. So our job is to really see that national health insurance is there at the podium, that it's one of the things that people are considering. It's one of the things that people are debating, because only national health insurance can cover all Americans in an affordable way. And as we've talked about earlier, that would be done because of the tremendous administrative savings you get off of national health insurance.
In the mid-90s, we were hearing a lot about how managed care and HMOs were going to control health care cost inflation. It seemed like that was working for a little while, but in the last couple of years, they've started rising again. What happened?
Well, there were some relatively easy savings that managed care got out, mostly by demanding discounts from doctors and hospitals. But the doctors and hospitals can't really discount the costs below the cost of the underlying cost of delivering the care. So once those easy savings were gone, we found managed care wasn't really able to do much. What they did was jack up administrative costs and really eat up most of the savings that they got from those discounts through their administrative costs. We are seeing prices go up again. And again, it's fairly widely accepted within the health policy community that managed care is no longer doing the job in terms of controlling costs, that it was a one-time savings, and we got those one-time savings such as they were in the early 90s, and there's no further savings coming. I have to say I'm not a supporter of managed care. I think a lot of the savings were, in fact, extracted from patients and forcing patients to go without needed care, to accept shoddy and inconvenient care when they got sick. So I'm not a supporter of managed care, but whatever savings there were, we've gotten those savings, and any further cost control, we're going to have to come up with a different way of doing it.
And we're just out of time now, but what could people do who are interested in hearing more and agitating for some kind of national health program?
Okay. Well, you can visit the website of our organization. Our organization is Physicians for a National Health Program. We have nearly 10,000 physician members who advocate single-payer national health insurance for the U.S., and our website is World Wide Web, www.pnhp.org. So PNHP, the initials for Physicians for a National Health Program. Look at that website, and there's lots of links to non-physician organizations, to organizations of other healthcare workers, of lay people, that people can link up through through that website.
All right. Thank you for joining us.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me.
Steffi Wilhandler, who is the co-author of a piece in Health Affairs magazine, Paying for National Health Insurance and Not Getting It, and prominent in Physicians for National Health Program, PNHP.org is their website. And back in a moment with Michael Perlman. And again, that was another excerpt from Fisher Spooner's Natural Disaster, which seems appropriate to the health insurance industry. Unnatural disaster, perhaps, but disaster nonetheless. And again, Physicians for National Health Programs website, www.pnhp.org. And now we're joined by Michael Perlman, who teaches economics at California State University at Chico and is an extremely prolific author. I've written a couple of books in my life, and it was just excruciating. Michael writes like one book a year, and they're all good. I don't know how he does it, but he's a force of nature. Welcome to WBAI, Michael Perlman.
Well, thank you very much.
Michael's new book, Steal This Idea, Intellectual Property Rights and the Corporate Confiscation of Creativity. First of all, I guess a lot of people know what intellectual property rights are, but could you just quickly define them before we move on?
They're monopoly rights granted by the state to the owners of people who are given credit for some sort of creative activity.
And that's defined very broadly, right? It could be
very
anything
broadly.
From writing a poem to designing a microchip.
Exactly. Or your gene.
Or your gene.
Yes.
So who can I copyright my own genes, or who can?
You can copyright anybody's gene.
And
they're making it a little bit more difficult, but until very recently, yeah. There were people who had various parts of their body copyrighted.
For what purpose?
So that a company could have the exclusive right of selling that, a replication of that particular part of your body. There was a man named Moore out in California, and the University of California doctors kept calling him back for more and more blood tests. Well, it turned out they figured out that he had a unique kind of blood. They patented his blood, at least a part of his blood, for medicinal purposes.
And they patented his blood and their name?
Yes.
And that's legal?
I assume if he needed, for some reason, some more of his blood, he would have to pay a royalty.
That's
to the people who discovered his blood.
Quite amazing. Yes. What is the history of patents and copyrights and other intellectual property assertions?
Well, within the United States, a very interesting history. First of all, it was put in the Constitution by an accident. Secondly, for years and years, until the end of the 19th century, they did not recognize copyrights from abroad, that authors would come to this country, like Charles Dickens, and rant and rave about that we're all a nation of thieves because we wouldn't pay for his books.
Very much like complaints about China today, right?
Yes. Railroads, corporations were notorious about stealing inventors' ideas. There was a Supreme Court decision that said that an inventor who invented a braking system that kept the railroads, when they broke, put on the brakes, they would crumple up very often. And caused terrible accidents. Someone invented a dual braking system that would resist this. The Supreme Court ruled, based on a brief that the railroads gave, that someone else would have invented it if you hadn't. So we don't have to pay you a damn thing.
And, of course, the one of my favorite stories is how the U.S. chemical industry stole German chemical patents during the war.
Yeah, but then they were too primitive to know how to use the German chemical patents. When they did it, they were able to, they acquired the legal right to them, but they didn't even know how to use them.
So, I mean, the U.S. then, I mean, let's look at this in the longer term. The United States, back when it was, you know, a developing nation, we can say, was very casual about other people's intellectual property rights and stole everything it could.
Yes.
And then, in the last few years, the United States has been very busy asserting these property rights in international negotiations through the WTO and such. When did this change of heart happen?
It's a cyclical phenomenon. It goes with the business cycle. When there's a slowdown, they look for a new way of increasing profits. That is, if you go back to the late 19th century, most of your libertarian economists, which included most of the economists, were violently against patents and copyrights. It was a market. It was a monopoly. It was a violation of markets. There's no place for this in a free market. The slowdown started around 1873, and all of a sudden they started, patents, copyrights, and they started pushing for it. Also, the patents were very useful at the time because the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed. And it was a way of excluding competitors without violating the Antitrust Act as it had been written. So patent pools became very, very common at that point. Then again, the United States economy slows down during the late 1960s, and at that point, there was a big push by various corporate leaders calling for more intellectual property powers.
And I should say I'm speaking with Michael Perlman, author of the book Steal This Idea, Intellectual Property Rights and the Corporate Confiscation of Creativity, just published by Palgrave Books. But you quote some Friedrich Hayek, among other people, probably the most iconic right-wing economist of the last century, as being not too fond of the idea. So I mean, the sort of principled opposition to the idea of patents and copyrights did...
All of the libertarians were against it.
And why were they against it?
Because it's a monopoly. It gives one person exclusive control, which is antithetical to the nature of markets, which are supposed to be anybody's free to enter and do whatever they want.
Now, of course, the standard response for that is that granting people that, and it's a temporary monopoly, it expires after some period of time, but that encourages innovation and creativity, and without it, we'd be stuck in a stagnant and dull culture.
Yes, that takes a long time to explain. First of all, what we're doing with intellectual property day is, now I'm putting aside music and books and things like that, but I'm thinking more in the realm of patents. What we're doing is we're living off of the seed corn of public investment that has gone before us. And what we're seeing now is that the intellectual property is now just extracting value from that previous science, but we're not putting new basic science back into it. What we're doing is we're starving the universities for basic science. The universities then go to the major corporations. The major corporations go to get their intellectual property, but we're not putting anything back in the ground.
Now, this contradicts everything you hear in you know, the media these days about this is a time of unprecedented innovation and scientific advance. You don't quite agree with that?
No. Yes and no. It's a time of innovation. It's not a time of scientific advance.
What's the distinction?
The distinction is innovation is more or less taking basic science and using it. For example, the electronics of the computer comes from physics that was done at the turn of the century, turn of the last century. So it took 40, 50 years to mature. Usually people think about a time lag of 20, 30, 40 years before a basic scientific invention turns into something that you see in the marketplace. So the post-World War period, and during World War II, there was an enormous investment in public research. Scientists were given unprecedented resources to go out and develop things, and that's what we're living off of now. Innovation would be to more or less taking these things and creating some new gizmo or gimmick that you can use. And you could buy at Circuit City or at the drugstore.
So it's more the D part of research and development, more the development part and not the basic research part.
Exactly.
And what's happening with basic research now?
It's being stifled.
By?
It's being stifled. It's not like someone saying stop doing basic research, but the funding isn't there. The funding's there for doing more applied research. That is, when a company like Novartis goes in and buys one of the departments at the University of California, they're not doing it to do basic research. They're doing it because part of their purchase of that department is that they get first rights to any sort of intellectual property that comes out of it.
So they're basically interested in creating patentable drugs that can make a lot of money.
Exactly. And when the university comes and hires you, Doug, one of the things they'll ask you is, how much money will you be able to bring in? Not how much money. You won't be asking them, how much will you be paying me? They're asking you, what sort of contracts do you think you can get?
So scientists are expected to bring, like, a bag of money with them?
Yes. Yes. Either their research will be something that will attract corporate funding, or their research will be something that the university will be able to patent and make money off of.
And also the standard line is, you know, in public, is that innovation is something that lone entrepreneurs do in garages, and, you know, they create this miracle new product and patent it and get rich from it. How does that actually comport with the reality of the way the products are developed?
Well, like I said, most of it comes out of public research. Most of it. And the other thing that I should have mentioned is that with this new emphasis on intellectual property, science, which grows out of a natural tendency of scientists to communicate, relies more and more on secrecy, which, again, stifles scientific progress. That is, I'm not going to tell you what I'm doing. I may tell you some vague part of it, and you could say, that's interesting. But the stuff that's potentially valuable, I'm not going to tell you about it. You could go out and beat me to it.
Now, the historical way that science was done, though, is that you're supposed to publish your results in ways that would allow other researchers to reproduce them and see if you discovered something real, or you're trying to pull a fast one on people. Is that being undermined now?
Absolutely. For example, in a whole list of cases, people get contracts to go out and publish, to do research. And if the research doesn't come out the way the corporation likes it, they're forbidden to publish it.
So, if we're eating our seed corn, how much is left in the bin?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not saying that tomorrow morning when you wake up, all innovation will stop. That's, of course, not the case at all. But what we know is you look backwards and you can see how these basic scientific achievements lead later to marvelous products. Some aren't so marvelous. And we're not putting that back into basic science anymore.
Well, you've talked several times about how a lot of basic science is funded by public funds. Could you give some examples of what you mean?
Internet was public funds. Everything having to do with computers comes out of public funds. Most of the breakthroughs in drugs come out of public funds, and then the an individual company gets the right to come in and get intellectual property rights, even though government scientists have done the basic work.
So, are you saying that we should just drop intellectual property protection altogether, or what would you like to see done?
Well, I would certainly like to see a reversal of the massive strengthening of intellectual property rights that have gone on in recent years. I mean, that's absurd. What we see, for example, is, let me give you two examples to explain what I mean. As intellectual property rights develop, the legal problems become more and more difficult, and you get into a thicket of patent suits. And this has happened before in early types of science. For example, the radio is a perfect example. During the early days of radio, everybody started suing each other because all these scientific achievements were interlocked. It's impossible to say who invented the radio, who invented radar, who invented this or that. Because the radio was so important for the Navy, they just stepped in and they said, we want you people to produce radio equipment now. This was First World War. Forget about patents. We'll protect anybody from getting sued. Just produce. Forget it. After the war, what they did was they put together out of the Marconi Company, the British Marconi Company, the American Marconi Company, and General Electric, Westinghouse, they put together a new company called RCA, and said, you guys pool all your patents together, and there'll be no more suits. And then you had tremendous innovation in the radio industry. The radio industry leads to television and to the computer.
And sort of a collective approach to development and property.
Yeah. So the military, when the military sees something's important, they put a stop to the intellectual property because they know that it's detrimental to the development of science and technology.
All right, I'm afraid we'll have to end on that note because we're out of time. Thank you for joining us, Michael Perlman. The book is Steal This Idea, Intellectual Property Rights and the Corporate Confiscation of Creativity, just published by Palgrave. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Don't forget tonight again and through Sunday night at the Pioneer Theater, 155 East 3rd Street, the movie Occupation, which is about the Harvard Living Wage sit-in. That's, again, tonight, 6:40 through Sunday, 6:40 in the evening, 155 East 3rd Street. And till next week, that's it for me. And let's go out with a little more Fisher Spooner.